This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Images from the Moral Monday events in Raleigh show swarms of protesters surrounding the Capitol. A flashback to 50 years ago reveals remarkably similar scenes as civil rights activists call for equality outside the Capitol. Inside, a young reporter named Perry Dean Young witnessed history in the making. Late at night, lawmakers suspended the rules and voted to ban speaking out against the government at state universities. The indignant Young typed up an impassioned story calling the measure censorship by reactionaries. His passion for reporting started early and took him across the globe to Saigon at the height of the Vietnam War, and he joins us now. Perry Dean Young, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to that night at the state capitol in Raleigh.
Well, a small correction. It wasn't at night. It was first thing in the morning, and they suspended. It was supposedly the last day of the session, and nothing serious was being done. It was actually too late to introduce a real bill, and there were no other reporters sitting on the floor. At that time, we sat on the floor right beside the – it was the first year of that new building, and it was kind of a circus-like atmosphere with all those fountains and everything. Through the session, the civil rights movement had been going on outside, and the legislators had been pressuring Bill Friday to fire two professors in particular who had been involved in the demonstrations. And, of course, Bill Friday said absolutely not. You know, he stood up for academic freedom and freedom of speech. And then on the last day of the session, Jesse Helms had heard about this law in Ohio. And he got a hold of a copy of that and passed it along to Thad Ure, and Thad Ure gave it to these two freshman legislators. But it was very obvious that the things had been agreed to beforehand. They suspended the rules, passed it on a voice vote, with one lone representative from McDowell County standing up and saying, "Gentlemen, this is," and of course they all were. I think there was one woman in the House. "This is unconstitutional on its face." Well, I was so upset. Because the previous day they had voted to censor public television, and that I ran with the bill onto the floor of the Senate. I ran with the guys. They literally carried the bill onto the floor of the Senate. And then I went with all the fury of youth. Well, first of all, the president of the Senate, Clarence Stone, banged it into law. I mean, people, they were literally screaming at him. The Senate was much more divided, and Luther Hamilton especially. And once it died down, he said, "This is not worthy of the Senate of North Carolina." And they tried to rescind it the next day, but they just didn't have the votes. But I went to the UPI teletype machine. We typed our own stories in those days. And the wire went from New York to Mississippi. It was the same day or the day after Medgar Evers was shot. So it was a very busy wire. And I typed in, "Reactionaries in the North Carolina General Assembly have ramrodded another censorship bill into law." And Jesse Helms was UPI's biggest client at WRAL at that time. And he just happened to be reading the wire. And he didn't call my bureau chief. He didn't call the regional office. He called the president of UPI in New York and demanded I be fired. And I'll never forget going into the office and my bureau chief, who's still around, we're still friends, he said, "Well, you sure screwed up this time." And I can hear him to this day screaming in the phone to the president of UPI saying, "They are reactionary."
Well, okay, but you're not supposed to put that in the story. You tell that to your friends later over a beer, and then you say, "In a controversial measure late at night." Well, let me ask you.
Let me follow that up. Yeah. I learned an extremely important message there, because my story, they sent out a mandatory kill. I was with UPI several years. It's the only one I ever saw. It said, "Editors, we are no longer responsible for this. This is a mandatory kill. If you publish it, it's your own fault." And I learned just what you just said. You can't editorialize. Just say what happened. And I would have had a hell of a story that would have been published in every newspaper in North Carolina. Yeah. As it was, my story got killed.
And then just find somebody who says those reactionaries passed a censorship.
Exactly.
I know you've learned that since. Interestingly enough, you didn't get fired.
No, he wouldn't fire me. I love it.
And we should say this is 1963. And as you pointed out, Jesse Helms, nowhere near the Senate yet. He was a WRAL news commentator.
A crackpot who came on at midnight, I think.
of some acclaim later on, it turns out. But so just to kind of set the scene, and you were about, what, 22 years old or so?
22. Yeah.
So you're pretty young at the time, just figuring out the rules. This law, nobody knew it was coming.
No. The group that got it through knew. It was all coordinated with the Speaker of the House, and who was a Democrat, by the way. And these were Democrats doing this, all of them.
Majority Democrat. And we didn't make it quite clear enough what that speaker's ban would do. What would that law have done?
It banned communist speakers at state-supported universities. And, of course, that is such a violation of free speech that the university came very close to losing its accreditation. And in fact, they had to call a special session of the legislature to amend it and to rescind it so that the university didn't lose its accreditation. Yeah. But in reality, it was a slap at President Bill Friday, because he wouldn't fire these two teachers involved in the civil rights movement. It was a very dramatic session, by the way, in that incredible building, which is such a beautiful building, that Edward Durrell Stone building with all the fountains and the palm trees and all that, and all these rednecks from Podunk coming in there. And one Monday night, this did happen at night. The legislature is in session on a Monday night, and the demonstrators completely encircle the building. And you could hear the "We Shall Overcome," and they pretended nothing was happening. That it didn't to them it didn't exist.
Now, these were the earliest civil rights demonstrations you're talking about.
Yeah, 1963. Yeah.
So what do you think about when you see Moral Monday protests these days?
I think hooray, it's come again. You know, these things come in cycles. You know, I mean that mean puritanical streak is here in America. You know, Gore Vidal said it best. He said, "The Puritans didn't come here to escape prosecution. They came here because they weren't allowed to prosecute in the old country." I mean, you know, in Massachusetts, they put to death 25 Quakers in 1 year, hanged them because of their dissent from the dissenters. You know, so we've always had that kind of puritanical mean streak in America, and Moral Mondays, in spite of the religiosity, I love it because it's that same Martin Luther King voice of tolerance and justice. But
it is religiously based. I mean, and you have written, and I want to talk more about this a little later on, the fact that you have written about the moral majority and not in any way complimentary, and yet the Moral Mondays are deeply religious based, and I think they both would argue they're worshiping the same God.
I'm sure they would, and I would disagree. But whether they're worshiping the same God or just looking at God through mirrors, that's the question. You know, I think so many people, most people, see God through mirrors, and their own prejudices come out. You know, but there is a difference. I mean, Jerry Falwell's was a religion of intolerance and totally contradictory to the teaching of Jesus, as far as I'm concerned. And, as Thomas Jefferson said, you know, Jesus' philosophy, you don't get much better than that. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I mean, it's just basic human kindness and goodness. And when it crosses the line is when these people are absolutist, and that's the word I use in God's Bullets. Instead of fundamentalism, I say absolutist, because I don't care whether you're Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, Christian, whatever. If you think yours is the religion and everybody else is condemned, then it's kind of hard to deal with you. But when you're preaching, as the Reverend Barber is right now, tolerance and justice and goodwill and looking after poor people, nearly all the parables of Jesus all had to do with poor people or the lame, the people who couldn't take care of themselves. And here you have these people claiming to be Christians, and they're out there looking out for the rich people and the corporations. Yeah, God.
From a strictly literary standpoint, by the way, the first time in ancient literature that we see poor people in quotes, they actually get to speak for themselves. Their own voice is highlighted and put in quotes. So, interesting side note. But let me ask you how you got started reporting. How long had this been an interest to you, and how'd you get started?
Well, in high school, actually. I think I got 20 cents a line to call in stories to the Asheville Citizen. Yeah? And
that's more than you get now, you know. That.
Oh, exactly.
newspapers.
Now I get nothing. Yeah. I started a newspaper in high school, the high school newspaper. And I just always did that.
And yet, when you got to UNC Chapel Hill, I understand that you, when you went to the office of the Daily Tar Heel, you felt a little, you were intimidated. Is that true?
Yeah, my friends tell this story. A lot of things had happened. My father had died that year. I missed more days of my senior year in high school than I went. The farm, the business had collapsed, and I was a kind of emotional wreck, you know, aside from being secretly gay, you know. And I was just intimidated. And the University of North Carolina, I was able to live in this wonderful couple's basement and come to terms with myself. I mean, Chapel Hill was a kindly mother, alma mater, in every way for me. But all those rich kids, they were so self-confident. Well, they weren't all rich. You know, the people at the Tar Heel, a lot of them were poor kids from Hickory. But I walked in that office and I thought, oh, my God, you know, I couldn't even say my name. But I could be very bold. This is what you're asking about, I know. I could be very bold with a typewriter. I could really be bold. And I was taking a course that you had to publish two stories. And so I wrote the travel letter to the New York Times. And he liked my letter and bought my article. And right. So I sold my two articles for $65 each.
Intimidated by the Daily Tar Heel, instead he goes to the New York Times and gets published. Perry Dean Young, my guest on The State of Things. More of our conversation ahead on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with Perry Dean Young. And before the break, you talked about the tough year you had, your last year of high school. Tell us more about growing up. One of 13 kids, right?
Yeah, but I was the youngest by a lot. So most of the older ones were gone by the time I came around. Yeah, it was a pretty weird household. My father, his oldest son was dating a young college girl, and his first wife had died, and he took the girlfriend away from him, married her, and she became my mother. And so there were, and she was 25 years younger than my father. So I was a pretty strange household to grow up in. I grew up on a farm, though, and that part was wonderful. We had greenhouses, and we had 25 acres under irrigation, which was kind of unusual up in the mountains. I don't think there was another irrigated farm up there. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe the Vanderbilts had one. Nobody else had one.
In the mountains, western North Carolina. So you do get to UNC Chapel Hill. You you get two stories published in the New York Times. You did work for the Daily Tar Heel eventually.
I never
worked for the Tar Heel. Now, tell us a little bit about your coverage, too, because at some point you signed up with the Army Reserves, right?
Yeah, this is kind of a funny thing to happen. Well, in those days, the Reserve, you didn't go to war. That's why George Bush did it. That's why I did it. I wanted to go to Vietnam, but I didn't want to go as a soldier. And so they were about to draft me, and I joined an MP unit in Raleigh. And did basic training at Fort Benning, and then advanced police training at Fort Gordon. But then when I got out of basic training, I called the UPI. My regional bureau chief with UPI was now head of UPI in New York, and I called him and I said, you know, I'd like to go to Vietnam. And he said, well, you got to come and work on the foreign desk in New York for a year before we'll do that. And so I did that. It was a very exciting year in New York, by the way. It was 1967, and the riots in Newark, New Jersey. I'll never forget going into the riots, walking into the riots because UPI was too cheap to buy a car, to rent a car for me to drive. And I was walking right in, and the Molotov cocktails going all around me, and just unbelievable scene, destruction. And out of nowhere, this old black guy comes and puts his arm around me and says, honey, you got to get out of here. These people will kill you. And luckily, Jack Lawrence, whom I would later know in Vietnam, a CBS guy, comes around the corner, and I got a ride with him and got out of there. But wow. It was one of those things where your background comes out of the woodwork to embrace you. You know, the old guys, black and white, would call the young people honey, no matter what sex you were. You know, I love that story.
And you were saved from that. You know what? I mean, it was a fascinating time to be a reporter, both domestic, foreign policy, and the Vietnam War. What was it about that war that made you want to go there?
Well, it was the biggest story going, and it was the only war we had, as we kept saying. What can I say?
We changed all that later.
Yeah, and the other thing was, you know, I was a poor kid. The only way I could travel around the world was to have somebody pay for it. And UPI bought a round-the-world ticket. Pan Am ticket at that point was $1,200, and you got unlimited stops. And so I got one going and coming, you know. Yeah.
And you went, and you arrived on New Year's Day.
Yeah.
Vietnamese New Year.
I think it's the 29th. 29th or 30th, you know, yeah. Very close to what it is this year. Yeah.
And the Vietnamese New Year is known as Tet.
Tet, yeah. Yeah. It's a Chinese lunar New Year.
Yeah.
And you know, I was 27 years old, and there were parties all over town, you know, and I went to every one of them. At 3 a.m., my office called and said, if you can get across the street, come to work. Well, right down the street from us was the Vietnamese naval headquarters. 40 people were killed there that night. And so it was just, to me, it was never quite real because it was like a movie almost, you know.
And certainly a surprise attack. This is the Tet Offensive, of course, the effort by the Viet Cong to drive the Americans out. One large offensive. It failed, but it certainly took a huge toll. And it began that night, the night you arrived.
Right.
So what was it like? I mean, you certainly weren't expecting that, not in Saigon. I mean, there was trouble there, but it was not that sort of wholesale assault that you – what did you see that night?
Well, you know, General Westmoreland never quite understood this. There were attacks all over the place, you know, but especially up at Khe Sanh, you know. And Khe Sanh was a northern outpost. It had been a French outpost, which meant that the Viet Cong had the coordinates they had, and they had artillery in the hills all around it. Just aimed right down at it. They were just sitting ducks. It was really shameful. You know?
Yeah. And you, I just can't imagine what it's like to, because this is your first posting abroad, wasn't it?
Yes.
So here you are. You're still relatively young, and now this massive assault. Nobody knows. I mean, the military can't quite tell you what's going on, and your job is to report this thing day one.
Yeah. Well, I was young and good looking and thrilled to be in the Orient. I mean, it was just. Getting hit with it all at once, it was just thrilling. I can't tell you how exciting it was.
And you found a group, you became part of a group of young reporters, and you guys became pretty tight. Tell us about that group.
Well, Sean Flynn, Errol Flynn's son. Errol said he looked like me, but better. And Dana Stone, the two who were later captured in Cambodia and were never heard from again. They were the stars of the group. And Tim Page, this wacky Englishman who's still alive, but he went through unbelievable injuries. And he was just wacky, wacky Englishman. And the character in Apocalypse Now, the American reporter, is actually based on Tim. And Tim's very proud of that, along with getting arrested with the Doors in New Haven, Connecticut. That was his second most proud thing.
Emblems of the Age. But tell us about that group, because you said in a lot of ways, and you've documented at least the story of the two who went missing in Two of the Missing, the name of your book, it was almost a surreal experience given what the way you were managing yourselves, maneuvering through Saigon and everything that was going on around you.
Oh, yeah. Well, Michael Hare, in his book, Dispatches, in which he calls me the fullest flowering of Southern degeneracy, by the way, and I said, Michael, you didn't know the half of it. And he said, I don't want to know either. Michael said a very strange thing, which had been quoted all over the place. He said, Vietnam for us was the happy childhoods none of us ever had. And that's so true. We all had something weird in our past, and we found each other, and we found ourselves, you know. There are things you learn in war that you can learn nowhere else. And William James, you know, Henry James' brother, wrote a wonderful essay called We Need a Replacement for War. We Need a Civilian Replacement for War. I think he was talking about something like the Peace Corps or something like that, you know, but something where you're just kind of totally committed and I guess a little danger. I don't know.
But also, how much of that, because you talk about that and others have talked about this kind of adrenaline rush, addiction to the danger, to the excitement of it. I mean, that's part, has to be part of the experience you're talking about, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
How about the otherness of it? I mean, you had by now come to terms with your gay identity.
On one level, yes. I was certainly having enough sex. I was pretty good looking, you know, in those days.
Yeah.
And I was having enough sex, you know, but especially in Vietnam. But I wasn't dealing with it openly. I mean, there was no reason to. In Vietnam, as long as you were – there was a code of behavior, and as long as you behaved well, that was it. But if you violated that code, forget it. It didn't matter what you were. But your private life was not important. And that was another thing. I was very comfortable there, you know.
But you said, especially in this group of reporters, everybody knew, even though it was officially a gay intolerant environment, particularly the military environment, you felt accepted and everybody understood, knew, and it wasn't.
Well, I'm not sure about that. No, we never talked about it, certainly, no.
Yeah.
But Dana was bisexual, and so he and I, we were great pals. But again, we never talked about it. It was just something you didn't talk about. You know?
You said there's a code of conduct, and yet nobody cared. I mean, again, when I think about the reports out of Vietnam then and certainly since, codes of conduct don't seem to be part of it. It really seemed to be a kind of Wild West when it came to ethics and behavior.
Yeah, I guess you're right. But we had our own kind of personal – I meant by behavior, there were things you did and things you didn't do. It's hard to describe, you know, but in the battlefield – the interesting thing is you do what's right, and this is how war tests you. I mean, I'll never forget going into Hue, and there were people dropping on either side of me. It was really eerie. Well, we finally get across the river, and – there we are, you know, and I'm helping unload the wounded, and, you know, and here I'm an objective reporter, but I was doing just what you do, and you dodge and you survive, and, you know, once you survive the bullet, you feel good about it. You feel good about yourself, you know.
Well, tell us about Sean Flynn and Dana Stone and the book you wrote.
Well, To the Missing, it began as an article in Harper's because we were afraid that, that the communists would think that they were CIA people, because a lot of CIA people did disguise themselves as journalists, you know. And so we were doing Dana's wife, Louise, came and stayed with me in New York, and we were doing everything we could. And Walter Cronkite was a tremendous help in all this. He was chairman of the committee to free the journalists. There were 36, I think, at one time, journalists missing. And Louise was just a fireball. I mean, she was this kind of mousy, quiet Kentucky girl, but boy, when she got after her Dana got captured, she was flying all over the world trying to find out and get people to help him, you know. And it started out as an article in Harper's, but Louise said, we don't want them coming out of the jungle and laughing at us, so it's got to be realistic, you know. It's got to be warts and all, and in our case, it's got to be sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all, you know. And so it started out in Harper's, and the book, by the way, has been optioned for a movie ever since it came out in Harper's in 1972. And then I got a contract to do the book after the article came out in Harper's.
Will you read from us from the book?
Pardon?
Will you read from us or read for us from the book?
Sure. One reviewer said it was a creative hodgepodge, and Jim Shoemaker said it looks like he just dumped your briefcase and picked the pieces up helter-skelter. And I said, Shoemaker, I don't even have a briefcase. You know? But it was just little scenes and profiles and things from my diary and from other things. At Charlie Med now, waiting for a helicopter to come through the fog and carry me out of here with the wounded. 31 on the last two choppers. 9 dead here now beside me in those black rubber body bags that make it all seem so clean. Tape recorder plays Donovan. Sunshine comes softly in my window today. A young medic sweeps the floor with a bloody broom, whistling the tune. Vietnam was an appropriate place from which to view America during that cathartic year, 1968. The violence of Columbia and Chicago seemed to flow naturally from the same forces sponsoring the war. After the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy, I wrote a friend from Vietnam. I was standing at the Dong Ha airstrip when the news came over a little transistor radio. I quickly got 4 or 5 reactioners and phoned them into the UPI office in Saigon. An old gunny sergeant looked a little sad at first, said, "Don't really understand that sort of mentality that would do something like that." Then he thought of it and said, "But I guess the same mentality you have in a war. You don't like something, you kill it." When the base at Khe Sanh was finally abandoned, I interviewed several of the Marines who had lived through the siege. "It don't make sense," one of them told me. "If they can abandon it now, why couldn't they do it before so many people got killed and wounded?"
Perry Dean Young, reading from his book, Two of the Missing. Cover of that book has photographs of a photograph of Flynn and Stone. Would you describe that photograph for?
Well, it's a very unusual photograph. It was taken 16 minutes before they got captured. And Flynn is wearing flip-flops, cut-off shorts, and a T-shirt. And they're riding bright red motorcycles, which they had rented in Phnom Penh 2 days before. And they knew exactly what they were doing. By the way, they were sitting there arguing about whether to go around. There was a VC or Khmer Rouge roadblock just outside this village. And the other reporters were safely in the village in their Mercedes, chauffeured Mercedes. And Flynn and Stone had decided deliberately to go around the roadblock. And by the way, several other reporters had been able to get down there and photograph the communist troops moving into that area of Cambodia. And I guess they thought they could survive it. I don't know. Who knows what they were thinking.
Because it was heavily, as you suggest, there was a lot of Viet Cong activity, and they were going right there at the border and on the other side within Cambodia.
Right. They were right on the border.
On the border.
Yeah.
And that's the last we saw them. They were on that motorcycle, rode off, and that's the last anybody remembers seeing.
Right.
What made you decide to write the book? Why did you write it?
Oh, I just told it started out as an article in Harper's, and then I saw it as a larger book and was able to get a contract.
I'm wondering if it has been nagging at you. What happened to them? Did you feel personally responsible to sort of go in and get them and find out? I mean, was the mystery of what happened to them part of your motive?
I had a very weird response. A buddy at UPI called up and said, you know, we think they've been captured. We don't know for sure, but we think they've been captured. And my response was, I wish to hell I were with them. Because I was in a buddy of mine who was then editor of Rolling Stone. I wrote 2 or 3 pieces for Rolling Stone while he was an editor there. And we were in a popular place in Greenwich Village. And I was 28 years old, and I looked around, and I said, I feel like my life is all in the past. And he said, what the hell are you talking about? And I said, I don't know. I just feel like I've done everything I'm ever going to do. And to a certain extent, that's true.
Yeah. Well, still?
Yeah.
You did go back.
Nothing ever measured up to the thrill of Vietnam and the friends I had there and all that. There have been lots of wonderful experiences since then, but nothing ever measured up.
Mm. Well, you did go back. You returned to Cambodia and Vietnam in 2010. Tell us about that.
That was a wonderful experience. We had a reunion of war correspondents, but we also dedicated a monument in the heart of Phnom Penh. To the memory of all the correspondents who were killed. You know, some of them really brutally beaten to death, you know. Well, I mean, what's the difference? Brutality. War is brutal, yeah.
Right.
And it was a wonderful experience. George Hamilton, who had been a childhood friend of Flynn's, came with us and turned out to be a really delightful, warm, wonderful kind of person, very self-deprecating, very fun, very witty, very funny. But in his older years, he's become obsessed with Flynn's memory. He said, you know, up until now, I've been so busy, I never thought about it. But he was extremely close to Flynn, probably his closest friend, and was really puzzled by it. I mean, George famously dodged the draft, and he was dating President Johnson's daughter, and the president was scolding him for not going in the military, you know. And Flynn would say, you know, you really ought to come out there and see it for yourself. And George never had any interest in going. Yeah. But now he's obsessed with the memories, you know, sort of like I was.
Interesting. So you know, you made a comparison a minute ago about the violence in Vietnam and the violence at home. And in a sense, it was an extension of that. I mean, did any of that, and certainly this is something Martin Luther King made the connection and talked about, this kind of colonial imperial impulse that was part of what was wrong at home and wrong abroad. Was any of this sort of part of your thinking at the time, or did this come to you a little later?
I think it came later. No, I don't think at the time. We didn't think about what everybody was thinking about back here. Why are we in Vietnam? We didn't question it because it would get too personal and too weird. What were we doing in Vietnam? What was I doing in Vietnam? I don't know.
Well, no, so that's interesting. Again, this question about these childhoods, the happy childhood we'd never had. Was it for you a kind of a way to escape memories? And I think you once described that family of yours of 13 as highly dysfunctional.
Oh, dysfunctional doesn't begin to describe it.
Was it a way to recreate yourself? You're in a whole new place, this crazy
yes.
environment of violence, drugs, and everything's available to you.
And also incredibly beautiful. I mean, Vietnam is an incredibly beautiful, physically beautiful place. My God, the beaches, the mountains, the volcanic mountains and stuff are just incredible. And the people are just amazingly beautiful. And the most beautiful people in the world. They really are. And they write poetry. They sing songs. The whole scene, the whole situation was just incredible. And you put on top of that, these really glamorous friends, you know. For once, I was a member of a team. I was never athletic. I never made a ball team, never wanted to be on a ball team, you know.
We'll come back to this conversation. Perry Dean Young, we're going to take a break right now and come back as the state of things continues with Perry Dean Young. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, Perry Dean Young. Before the break, we were talking about your reunion trip to Vietnam in 2010. How had things in Vietnam changed?
Oh, dramatically. Where our apartment building had been on Tudor Street, it was an old decadent French building. There was now a 40-story hotel. There were skyscrapers everywhere. Saigon was like overnight had become New York City. It was incredible, you know. But we were able to, being able to drive around, that was an interesting thing to do. We drove from Phnom Penh to Saigon, which miraculously it took no time at all. But in the old days when you had, when you're going in and out with helicopters and all, and you couldn't drive on the roads, it was a big difference. But no, the communists they've leveled all the forests. It's unbelievable what they've done. And they've built these skyscrapers wherever they can. It's just unbelievable.
Did the story change for you? I mean, did going back sort of put things in perspective for you or give you a new view of what it was you were doing there or what your experience had been there?
I wish it had. I don't think so. I think it was just a kind of lark. And some of it, I was appalled, you know, when I went in the war museum there in Saigon, where they have the tiger cages and all that. I was really kind of sickened by it. But then again, I was kind of sickened by a lot that I saw at the time in Vietnam. So I don't think it was anything new. I think at the time I knew how obscene it was and how awful it was. I mean, you know, just look at what I just read. Those are notes I made at the time, you know,
yeah.
Where people are saying, if we can leave now, if we can abandon the base now, why couldn't we abandon it before all these people got killed? I just think it was such a waste of billions of dollars and thousands of lives, you know.
You have been involved in a lot of movements through the last 50 years, civil rights, women's rights, LGBT rights. Where did this passion for social justice begin, do you think?
My mother, no question. My father would have been a Tea Party a Republican, but my mother was a way ahead of her time as a female, a feminist, and just believed in, you know, that basic, you know, I don't believe in the religiosity that what's been done to Christianity, but there is a basic sense of goodness and being right. And treating people right, and when you look around you and see what's happening, you know, the country turned over to the corporations who could not care less about people, working people, you know. I think that was it. My mother instilled in this thing for the underdog and for people who didn't have as much. I mean, I can remember as a Boy Scout going around collecting food for people who were hungry in our neighborhood, and I mean, and things like that. That's just the way I was raised.
You know, it's interesting because, as you suggest, this all comes from a deep moral impulse, some sense of a greater right beyond what's immediately in front of you. You wrote a scathing book about the moral majority back before it really had a name, right?
Mm-hmm. No, moral majority. Well, I wrote what the book was about was how they formed a moral majority. Yeah. And it was a very cynical, this group of political operatives in Washington, and they chose Jerry Falwell to be the spokesman, but he really had nothing to do with it. He was just the out front guy, and all these other people, Richard Viguerie and all these other people who were political consultants, were the ones who decided to do this in the name of Christian fundamentalism. You know, three of them were Roman Catholic absolutists, and two of them were Jews. You know, so it was not a purely Christian thing that they did. It was pure cynical politics to create this force that would hit these issues that would get people aroused. And I mean, somebody said, you know, Jesse Helms, he probably didn't even know how to pronounce homosexual. He didn't even know what it was, but his advisors knew it was the kind of thing that would arouse people and would get people to give money. And, you know, that there was this threat out there, this paranoia that they have, you know, about that, you know, our values are being attacked. Well, what about the basic Christian values of being good to each other and being tolerant and wanting justice for all people? You know, those are the kind of values that were instilled in me. And those are the kind of values that I see in Reverend Barber, although I don't believe in his church. I don't believe in the God part. I do believe in the ethical part and the Christian values he's espousing.
But this is the tricky part, isn't it? Because now what we're doing is manipulating symbols, right? I mean, these things are not visible, gods and morals, or even values. Well, you give them a name and you give them maybe some iconography, and then you begin to manipulate. So the moral majority does it. Do you see any parallel between that and the Tea Party movement?
Oh, absolutely. It's the same people. they're just a younger generation doing it. They're manipulating people. And you might say that Reverend Barber and Moral Monday is doing a similar thing. But no, there is a difference. There's this tremendous moral difference. And both sides are using the word moral. But when you have a philosophy of exclusion and face that off against a philosophy of inclusion and tolerance and justice, there is a difference. I'm sorry.
You wrote a book in the mid-70s. You co-wrote a book with David Coppe, an NFL player who publicly acknowledged that he was gay. And this is in the 1970s. Tell us about that book.
Well, he was the very first major team player. Several have come out since then, but he was the very first. And at that time, you have to realize that homosexual acts were felonies in all but three or four states, and a few states had included homosexuals in their civil rights laws, but only in the Northeast. No, nobody anywhere else in America. Maybe San Francisco had, but nobody else. Yeah. And so it was quite interesting enough. In my book, Two of the Missing, which came out earlier that year, I had described my own homosexuality. And it caused no controversy at all. The Washington Star did this series of articles about gays in sports, and nobody would use their name. Coppe read those articles, and he said, well, at least I can do that. I can give my name. And that's what he did. Well, once he did that, it was unbelievable. I mean, the response was extraordinary. And he was on every major talk show. He appeared in every city in America. And we got more than 30,000 letters from people saying, that book changed my life. Mm. About 2 years ago, a friend of mine called me up and said, are you watching Good Morning America? And I said, no, I never watch TV in the morning. And he said, well, they're holding your book up. And it was Isera Tuaalo, who was who would have been a star with the San Diego Chargers, but he was so screwed up about his homosexuality. He actually played down because he felt if he got in the spotlight, they would find out that he was secretly gay. And he was ready to kill himself. And a friend of his said, "No, I want you to read this book." And so he held up the David Coppay story on Good Morning America and said, "This book saved my life." And those are the kinds of things you live for as a writer. You know, you don't get many of those.
You know. Did you expect that kind of impact?
Absolutely. I knew exactly historically how important he was. Merle Miller, who wrote the Harry Truman books and was once an editor at Harper's, he called me up and he said, "Perry, David Coppay has destroyed a stereotype overnight."
Do you think he has?
Yes.
It's unusual, and it's still big news these days when NFL players come out.
Well, there haven't been many.
No, well, they haven't come out. I mean, that's my question to you. Is it still pretty difficult, do you think, for professional athletes to come out?
Yes.
I mean, in that sense, don't we still have the stereotype that if you're a professional athlete in a violent sport, chances are you're not gay? That's a stereotype that you think has been eradicated?
The stereotype that's been eradicated is that gays are ineffectual sissies. That's what I was thinking. But you're right, the one of... The other side of that, I don't know. But interesting, one of Phil Donahue's last shows, he had Coppay on, and he also had the manager of the Mets baseball team. And there had been gossip that one of the baseball players was gay, and he denied it. Well, the manager went on to say, "Look, we are grown-ups. We're responsible men. We're not uneducated. We can deal with this, you know," but nobody else is saying it. No, they're worried about the box office. Vince Lombardi was Coppay played for Vince Lombardi at Green Bay, and then in Washington, went with him to Washington. He had three players. I mean, one got arrested in Washington, and the only reason he got fired was because he kept getting arrested at Lafayette Park, of all places, right across from the White House. But he had two other players, Jerry Smith, that he absolutely knew were gay. I mean, Lombardi's brother was gay, by the way. So he had no problem with it. And everybody in his front office was gay, too. His general manager was gay, and his public relations man was gay. So he had no problem. The problem they had was the box office. They're terrified that you know, this image of football is... So, yeah, that does still exist. Yeah.
Was it difficult for you to come out in your book and to write about it in Two of the Missing?
I guess so. There were people like Reynolds Price said, "Don't do this." He said, and he had in a memoir that I'm writing right now. I go and I quote Reynolds extensively, but I had help from some other people, Christopher Isherwood, who wrote the Berlin stories that Cabaret was based on. I was in L.A. staying with Tim Page and his wife, and just called up Isherwood on the phone. I said, "Listen, you wrote this book about being in Nazi Germany, having the time of your life and your sexual homeland, as you call it." And I said, I've written this book about Vietnam. I'm writing this book about Vietnam. And I had the same dilemma because I had the time of my life, but it was this horrible, awful, obscene war. And I said, "I would like to meet you." And he said, "Well, I would like to meet you." And so he came in, and we talked for a long time. And then I went back to Vietnam at that time, you know, to get the last chapter of the book. And then he helped me through it. It took 2 or 3 years for me to let go of that book. But Isherwood was extraordinary. And he said, "You know, who you are is always relevant." But other people, like a friend of mine, was in line to be the anchorman at NBC and was mysteriously fired because they knew he was gay. And he said, "Oh, for God's sake, why do you have to shout it from the rooftops?"
So why not? So you can't. So now you'd been all around the world. You'd written this book. You come back to Chapel Hill. Why?
I came back. A friend of mine was going through a very nasty divorce trial here. A friend of yours too, by the way. And he knew I was having trouble in Washington D.C. I had signed a contract to do a book with a congressman, and he reneged on the contract. And I really had nowhere to go. And this friend said, "Why don't you come stand by me? Because you're going through this trial." And I came back here for that. And then I got a contract to do a book called Gays and Lesbians in Sports, which was enough for me to come back to Chapel Hill and go to school. At age 53, I graduated in December 1993. I should have graduated in 63. And I made the dean's list for the first time in my life.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's great. So you came in. Well, who was that congressman? What would that book have been?
It was Cooter. He played Cooter on the Dukes of Hazzard, and he got elected from Georgia and beat an early Tea Party guy, by the way, before they called it the Tea Party down in Georgia. But then he lost the next election, but he was in there once. Ben Jones was his name.
You could have had a book about Congressman Cooter and the proto Tea Party. You still have to write that book, seems to me.
No, Ben has written the book himself.
He's got it himself. So what are you doing these days?
Well, I tend my gardens and...
You are living.
I worry a lot.
You were living in the basement of the Women's Center in Chapel Hill, right?
Yeah, I put an ad in the newspaper saying starving author will do gardening and work for rent, and that was 21 years ago, and I've been there ever since. Yeah. It's a wonderful place. They do counseling and for divorce and family problems. It's just a wonderful extended family of people.
And you're looking after the place and the garden,
right?
Got yourself a place in the basement.
Right. It's only two rooms, but that's all I need. Wow. And I do. I buy and sell used and rare books, too. I have an online bookstore. Yeah.
Well, speaking of women's issues, you wrote a play. Was it the Frankie Silver you wrote about? Is that a play?
I wrote a book.
The book about Frankie Silver.
And then I wrote a play that Southern Appalachian Repertory Theater produced. And Frankie, she's a much maligned, much misunderstood woman in history. She was hanged in 1833. And in all the stories, they say she was the first woman ever hanged. She was not. She was not even, there were at least 15 hanged. And she did not sing a ballad from the gallows. And the story has nothing to do with Frankie and Johnny. That's a black blues song. There is a ballad associated with it and all of it. And I wrote that book mainly to get the facts, because there turned out there were a hell of a lot of documents, because she was in jail for a year, which was very unusual in that time, because they didn't have prisons. They just had jail. But through a set of circumstances, she stayed in jail. And by that time, the people in Morganton, where she was in jail, they decided she was innocent, that her husband had beat her, and he picked up a gun, she picked up an axe, and her aim was better than his was. But she'd just been misrepresented ever since. And as part of, again, the feminist background with my mother, I guess, coming out.
But it's interesting how that 19th century story about a woman who probably did kill her husband, but under those circumstances, a man who was drunk and abusive and about to kill her, is still now a celebrated feminist cause, in large part because you've written about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, the healthy thing is that her descendants are now no longer ashamed of the fact that their ancestor killed somebody, because they realized there was another side to the story. What I found, I had inherited a bunch of papers from a lawyer in Asheville who was supposed to be her lawyer. It turned out he was not. And I went looking for more information, and in the archives I found all these petitions to the governor and letters from people trying to save her when she was in jail. And in there were all these details about how her husband beat her at a time when female delicacy would most forbid it. And so then the book was out for quite a while, and then Bill Gregg, who's the theater director at Mars Hill College, called me up and said, we have a play about Frankie Silver, and we'd like to revise it. Would you be interested? And I said, well, is the play any good? And he said, no. And I said, well, let's write a whole new play. And we did.
Perry Dean Young, writer, author of several books, including Two of the Missing, as well as plays. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Perry, thanks so much. What a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Sean Wen, Megan Mataferi. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.